This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson, and tonight we are going to have a discussion about atheism and agnosticism once we leave the church. I'm joined by two individuals who have been with us before, so they've proven their mettle and they're ready to go at it again. First of all, from way back in episode two, we have Jason, a.k.a. Dr. Shades. Welcome, Jason.
Good evening, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And secondly, we have Lauren. Lauren also goes by the moniker of the Dude, and he was with us back in episode 14 on Science and Disbelief. Welcome, Lauren.
Hey, John. Good to be here.
All right. The reason I've brought these two distinguished gentlemen on, and I'm including myself in this one, is we both, or all three of us, share the distinction or infamy of having left the church and arrived at some sort of agnosticism or atheism. And tonight we kind of want to explore that a little bit. Maybe first of all, we should level set. I'm not sure everybody who listens to this podcast is really quite aware of the difference between, say, agnosticism and atheism. Do either one of you want to take a shot at that?
For me, this is Lauren. I really don't mess around too much with the terms and the difference between atheist and agnostic. I think everybody thinks they know what those things are. And when you label yourself, really you're not, I don't think you're getting a chance to say what you are. Basically, you're putting yourself into the box of what those people already think it means. So if I say I'm an atheist and an evangelical Christian is hearing that, he probably thinks, oh, I'm some arrogant jerk who thinks that I know there's no God. And that's not what I mean when I say atheist. So I said on the earlier podcast, for me, I don't say atheist, agnostic, whatever. I say I'm skeptical, basically.
Okay. As for me, I'm on the agnostic scale, and I tend towards atheism. I'm probably a agnostic borderline atheist. And for me, well, yeah, Lauren, you've got a good point about not allowing other people to pigeonhole you. But at the same time, sometimes it's good to have words, you know, just to have them, because every kind of word is reductionistic to some extent or other. So just putting it in a quick nutshell, an atheist, yeah, once does not believe in God, just like an agnostic doesn't necessarily believe in God. But the way people have come to mean it is that, of course, an atheist believes there is no God, whereas an agnostic would believe that or would not know or would not claim that there's enough evidence to say either or whether there is or is not a God. Those are, of course, quick and easy ways to put those terms. But yeah, you're right. It is a lot. It is a bit more nuanced. It's not good to be pigeonholed.
Well, for example, I mean, you know, Jason, what do you mean when you say you don't believe in God? Do you mean like a personal monotheistic God, or do you believe like a creator? Do you believe like something that's, you know, greater than humans? I mean, what do you mean? What are you atheistic of?
Okay, well, I'm atheistic of, let's see, I'm atheistic in the sense that I'm not convinced that there is a supreme being or a divine being of some sort, especially not one that, you know, created us and created the universe. So my stance is that I just plain don't know, and that I seriously doubt whether there is such a being in existence. So, no, I don't believe in one actively.
Okay.
Well, I think for a lot of Christians, and Lauren mentioned evangelicals who tend to drive a lot of this debate, atheism is kind of an affirmation of some sense of faith. And I heard recently somebody define that there should be two terms, atheism as opposed to anti-theism, because there's a lot of course, the militant guys out there who are out there, you know, trying to make the case and make the cause, and they're sort of against religion and against any sort of belief at all, and they really want to push that rational view. And I think that's different than most people who would label themselves atheist, because for most of us, I think it's just a certain lack of belief. You know, the cliche is almost trite now. You know, atheists tend to say, well, I'm as atheistic towards, say, Jehovah as I am to Zeus. I just don't believe in either one of them. And it's not that I'm actively anti-Christianity or anti-Judaism or anti-whatever. I just have no belief. I don't believe in Thor. I don't believe in Zeus. I don't believe in Jehovah. I don't believe in the God Jesus.
How about if I throw one more term out there? You talked about anti-theism versus atheism. Now, for some strange reason, atheism seems to have kind of become a bad word in American society and who knows what other society. So what if we switched out atheism for non-theism? That way we can avoid that whole stigma entirely. So anti-theism and non-theism might be, you know, better descriptors for, you know, the new decade.
Well, there's a good point there. I think atheists, unfortunately, are largely defined by their enemies. Most of the people talking about atheism, up until recently, were from a religious context. And it was always lumped in with every other sort of malcontent and evil doer out there. You know, we all know the statements by George Bush and George Bush Sr. And, you know, it's been okay in the public forum to actually, you know, say atheists shouldn't have rights and all sorts of things that would be horrific if applied to a race or any other sort of group.
Yeah, you're totally right. And that's, you know, another reason why I don't throw out there that I'm an atheist. It's not a badge I pick up because it's associated with bad things in this country. And really, I'm just skeptical, you know, and I'm more skeptical towards certain versions of God than other versions of God. If you want to tell me that God is someone that grants wishes and keeps a log of personal behavior, then, you know, I'm extremely skeptical of that sort of God. If you're just talking about a God that, you know, that maybe hit start and the universe began, you know, gee, I may be a little less skeptical towards that, but I still don't have any active belief towards it. So that's, I don't know. I avoid the term atheist for the reasons that you said, you know, the things that the perception that people have of that term, unfortunately.
That's pretty smart. Now, when people ask you what you are or what you believe, how exactly do you respond? What words do you use?
As I said, I say I'm skeptical of religious beliefs. And I leave it at that, you know. For a lot of people who don't want to, who really aren't curious and just want to pigeonhole me, that's enough. People who are curious might ask a few more questions and I can go into it.
Good strategy.
Luckily, people don't ask very often. It's not a really polite question to ask somebody.
At least no, it's not, right.
You know, but it may not be, but then again, it's almost inevitable that when somebody finds out that you're no longer a believer in Mormonism or you used to be a Mormon at one time, that question seems to pop up quite often, doesn't it?
The question, are you an atheist?
Or not necessarily, are you an atheist, but, you know, so what do you believe in now or what are you now?
Oh, right, because often they assume that you've converted to some other religion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, at least if your experience is anything like mine, and that seems to be almost the next question out of their mouths.
Right.
Jason, I think you raise a really great point as far as Mormonism goes, because I do believe you're right that a lot of Mormons, when they query, they say, what are you now? Because Mormonism is so integral to identity and to what people think about themselves and how they place themselves in the world. Frankly, at least for me, my atheism doesn't really color my worldview that much. It's not integral to who I am because I'm more an ex-Mormon than I am an atheist because Mormonism was such a part of my identity. But it doesn't really color, you know, like moral decisions I make or financial decisions or it's and I don't think that people who are very religious can understand that religion as a guidance is not very integral in my life. And that's not
okay.
That's not to say I'm not moral or I don't choose, you know, ethics or other sort of things. It's just not guided by a belief in an abstract deity.
Same here.
Yeah, me too. And I've kind of had the interesting experience of, you know, being a father I have two kids. One is in elementary school and one is in junior high. And we never talk about God. You know, there's never been religion in our home. And they've had the experience of living in, you know, a number of different cities and, you know, having kind of a regular turnover of friends and interactions. And, you know, so they've been exposed to a lot of other beliefs, but for themselves, they've never picked up the term atheist. We've had some discussions about religion, but mostly it's been in terms of, you know, how do you deal with other people who have these beliefs, and especially how do you deal with mom and dad's family, extended family, who are Mormons and have kind of these unusual, what seems to them, very unusual practices.
Yes, that's very much the same for us. We have two children, both elementary age. And yeah, religion, they're not being raised religious, and it doesn't ever enter the conversation. It's not been a problem. I mean, we don't have any problem teaching them not to steal or not to, you know, lie or not to hit. You don't have to rely on God to do that. But yeah, we sometimes caution them, you know, there's things you can't say at school. You know, we're in the South, so especially you don't say that Jesus is imaginary or things like that, because it'll get you in trouble. But other than that, they don't seem to have a lot of questions. But, you know, we'll talk about them frankly. And we have some children's Bible books around here and that sort of stuff. So if they're curious, we can walk them through that sort of thing. But, Lauren, you're right. The biggest challenge is when they're around, you know, my parents in particular. Not that my parents are challenging, but because, you know, they pray over all their meals and they throw out that sort of terminology a lot more often, and we have to kind of help balance that out.
As you probably know, I have another, you know, website dealing with, you know, LDS topics. And, I get a lot of emails from people who say, okay, well, I've just, you know, found out the straight dope and I'm kind of confused. I don't know what to do now. You know, what do I do for my kids, or how do I raise my kids, or what do I raise my kids believing? It's really interesting to me how many people who are fresh out of the LDS church, you know, they always seem to ask, you know, what do I do about my kids, or what do I teach my kids? And, I always respond, well, your kids are probably a lot more interested in Xbox and PlayStation than they are about God. So don't even worry about it. Because, I mean, kids just are not, if you leave kids alone, they're just not really interested in that sort of thing, in religion, God, and that sort of thing. And I can't remember where I heard this, but I read someplace that every child who is ever born is always born an atheist. They have to be taught to believe in things like God or, you know, other unseen things, you know, later on.
Yeah, my experiment with my own kids has proven that to be true. I guess a religious person would say, well, Lauren, that's just because you are inadvertently indoctrinating your children with atheism. But I don't think that's the case. We don't talk about it. And so sort of the neutrality that exists in our home has allowed my two kids to grow up in what I think is a more natural state, which is not believing in God and not believing in magical forces and, you know, wish fulfillment and, you know, a lot of the things that religion, you know, gives to children.
I think you make a really good point. And I think that sometimes I've heard a religious apologist accuse atheism of being just another faith. That it's got all the aspects of religion. It's just under a different name. But to your point, if you look at the way it actually plays out in my home, we don't talk about religion. We don't have any sort of traditions or anything around atheism. The only traditions we tend to honor are our native Christian ones, you know, like Christmas and Easter and that sort of stuff. We don't have any problem putting up a Christmas tree or giving presents. So, but there's nothing there that would signify or look like a religion, because we just don't talk about it.
Right. Those things can be done in a totally secular way. And that's what we do as well.
Yeah. You know,
Christmas, you know, with the tree and the presents.
Yeah. You know what? Always seems to it always gets my goat whenever people say that atheism or religion, or you're just as dogmatic as any religionist is. And my response to that is, if atheism is a form of religion, then infertility is a form of parenthood.
Or baldness is a form of, you know, hairstyle or hair color.
Right.
That too, I guess.
Yeah, but I guess in their defense, I don't think I would have understood it myself until I experienced it. Now, I never talked. I can't remember ever talking to anybody who claimed to be an atheist before I became one. But I don't know why they don't take our word for it. Why they all think we're just lying about it? Because yeah, especially if you get in online debates or that sort of thing with religious people, they just think that all these things that we lay out with atheism are just not true. That we're just full of lies.
Strange how that works, isn't it?
All right. One thing I want to circle back around. Now, forgive me, Lauren. I can't remember. Did you serve a mission?
Yes, I did.
So all three of us served LDS missions. So we made it at least that far. That means at some point in our lives, we probably had some vestigial belief in God. And we all ended up to this point. I want to kind of look at that journey for each of us to say, how exactly did you end up where you're at?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, something that you hear a lot from people when maybe if you are a Mormon and you are having trouble with your belief, they may say, well, you know, whatever happens, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Meaning like, you know, if you decide not to believe in Joseph Smith, you know, at least keep believing in God. Or when they try and explain to you why you left the church, you know, people who have the arrogance to do that, they say, well, you just threw out the baby with the bathwater. But to me, I think looking back, the baby was the bathwater. I believed in God because of Joseph Smith, because of the foundation of Mormonism that had been delivered to me since I was a babe. And when that foundation kind of crumbled apart, I didn't have an independent reason for believing in God, and certainly not for believing in Jesus Christ. That all came from the church and the Book of Mormon, etc. And so when I discarded the church, discarding God just kind of came naturally with it. Now, maybe it's very different for people who are converts and maybe who had a Christian background that was different from mine and became converted to Mormonism. For them, it might be easier to go back to some form of Christianity. But for me, it was natural to just discard the whole thing. The baby was the bathwater.
That's interesting, Lauren, that you should mention that particular process, because so often I have interacted with Christian people who say that the most insidious thing about Mormonism is that when people leave, they completely lose faith in God and Christ. And, you know, it seems that your experience pretty much paralleled their observation.
Well, in my case, it did.
Okay, in my case, my story is a little bit different from yours. John, you mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of us have, you know, served missions and so forth. It's funny you should say that, because I became an LDS missionary precisely 20 years ago today.
Oh, congratulations.
So I'm celebrating an anniversary. What's that?
I said congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you very much. 20 years, you know, later, I never imagined that I'd be, you know, here on a podcast about atheism, but there you have it. Anyways, in my case, after a lot of research, soul studying and so forth, I finally, after I came to the conclusion that Mormonism was most likely untrue after all, I had a very, very brief period where I thought, well, maybe some other Christian church is true, and maybe, you know, I guess I just have to go back to some other form of belief in Christ and so forth. So I did the whole thing with, accepting Jesus as my personal savior and pondering and like contemplating, you know, what kind of church I should join and so forth. But that was a very, very, very brief phase. You know, it didn't last long at all.
And how brief was that for you, Jason?
Oh, gee, it's kind of difficult to put a beginning and end time to it, but I guess maybe like a couple of weeks, 2.5 weeks, something like that.
So, because I did that too for about 24 hours.
Oh, okay. Well, mine was slightly.
I mean, I thought about it. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So, after I kind of got to that phase, I had to stop, put the brakes on it, remind myself, well, wait a second, you know, just because there were problems with Mormonism, that doesn't mean that there aren't problems with Christianity too. Well, before I, you know, once bitten, twice shy, as they say. So I may as well look into Christianity too and make absolutely sure that it doesn't suffer from a lot of the same problems that Mormonism does. So, of course, I looked into Christianity as well and so on. And my brief flirtation with Christianity didn't really last very long after that. Because
so in my case, I mean, I said I sort of, you know, considered Christianity for a brief period of about 24 hours. And I realized that the reason I was doing it was for social reasons. It was because I felt like, you know, there must be a group out there that's, you know, that's like me, that has something. And it didn't take very long to realize, well, it's not the Christians that have what I, you know, what I'm missing.
That's interesting, because to me, it was never a social thing at all. I thought that, you know, just because Mormonism may not be all I thought it was, doesn't mean that there isn't a God, doesn't mean that Jesus Christ didn't exist and so forth. So, you know, maybe I am actually commanded to go and search out a Christian church and, you know, give my obeisance to God that way or something like that. Or maybe I am expected to follow Christ anyway, you know, Mormonism or no Mormonism. So that's what caused me to at least try to not, as you said, throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm.
But then, right. But then again, I of course had to continue studying and so forth to make sure that, you know, once again, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. That sort of thing. So, yeah. I also, somebody said I read something online that someone had posted, talking about, you know, intelligent design and you know, God starting up the universe or God creating the universe and so forth, and all the different diverse forms of life that exist. Somebody said, okay, let's say that there isn't a God. Now, if there was not a God, and if the scientists are correct about all the different ways that life came about, how the Earth came into existence, evolution and so forth, would the Earth and would life on Earth look any different than it does now? And I realized, no, the Earth does not look any different with a God than without a God. So why should I, you know, multiply possibilities and, you know, why should I make assumptions that there's more going on than is going on? Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, I think it makes perfect sense. I think that people assume that it's very, you know, it's a clear argument that if there wasn't a God, things would be different. But when you ask, you know, for details, how would it be different? It's, nobody can pin that down how it would be different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Plus, there's the evolution debate. They say some people go back and they give a few concessions to reality and say, well, maybe God used evolution as his creative process. And then my rejoinder is, well, evolution doesn't need God. You know, evolution just happens anyway. So why should we posit something that there's no evidence for when evolution works perfectly fine without a God?
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds like you were speaking past each other there. You know, you're saying the weight is on the believer to explain why we need a God. And the other guy is saying, no, I already believe there's a God. I'm not accepting that weight. I'm just making it compatible with evolution.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly. Right. Why bother making it compatible when it's not necessary?
Right.
I mean, when a God is not necessary, that is.
Well, I think that believers have basically other reasons for believing in God besides necessity. Besides necessity that they can explain to you. Maybe some, you know, kind of emotional or habitual necessity that is just inherent in them.
Yeah, I'm sure we can have a whole nother podcast about, you know, why such a belief is necessary.
Yeah, it's an endless topic, I suppose, and I'm sure there's psychology and philosophy and everything else mixed in. I was really very similar to both of you in terms of wanting to embrace Christianity, but for me, I saw it as a destination, but I never quite got there. As my faith in Mormonism started to shatter, I started to study Christianity more in depth, and unfortunately, I applied the same sort of rigorous you know, historical methodology I did to Mormonism, and Christianity doesn't fare much better. Probably fares worse, actually. I've argued before that there's more evidence that Joseph Smith had the Book of Mormon than there is evidence that Jesus actually lived. But so I think as I approach that stage of trying to be what I figured would be more like a liberal Christian, I just never got there. And I fully intended to. I fully figured when I first started having real serious doubts and I first started entertaining the idea that I might leave the church, I figured I'd keep my Christianity intact, but it just didn't happen. Which is interesting for me. you know, there are a lot of Christians and evangelicals out there who argue that Mormonism is not a Christian religion, and I don't want to get into the nuances of that argument, but for me that was the case. When I stripped away Mormonism, there was no Christianity left underneath there. Then, and when I read Christian philosophy and Christian, I went through and read a systematic theology book, and I read the history of the Christian church in Europe. I found it was very alien to me, that the language they were using I didn't understand. So from that aspect, when I pulled away the Mormon belief, I wasn't left with some sort of neutral Protestantism.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm sure that a lot of believing Christians don't really understand that about Mormonism, that it's such a huge, all-encompassing thing. It's not just a some add-ons that are that you snap on to a core belief in, you know, Christianity. I mean, it's its own whole all-encompassing thing.
Yes, and
well, I think, you know, I'm gonna disagree a little bit, because I think that there are many different kinds of Mormons, you know, and they're all three of us, I believe, were born and raised in the church, right?
Yes.
Not born, but so, more or less raised.
More or less raised. Okay. So you guys were like me, where to a large part, you know, the baby was the bathwater. You believed in Jesus and God because of Mormonism. But to, you know, I think there are other types of Mormons out there, especially converts, maybe people who didn't grow up in Utah also, who have still maybe a Christian belief that is apart from Mormonism, who can, you know, leave Mormonism but still believe in Christianity. I think for me, at least, a lot of what happened to me comes from the fact that I was born and raised in the church. I didn't know something else.
Yeah, thanks, Lauren, for throwing that out there, because I guess you are right. I guess I was engaging a little bit of, you know, what they call projecting there. So, yeah, good point.
I also think, to your point, if we take the traditional Mormon God, that guy is pretty easy to dismiss. He's flat out silly. If you have a God that exists in a place in the universe, you know, a God that has hair and has a spleen and has an anus and has all that sort of stuff, that, and you know, we're talking very traditional sort of Heber Kimball, Orson Pratt, Brigham Young views, that just doesn't jive today. And what I think is interesting in Mormonism, to your point, Lauren, is a more traditional view of Christianity has now been grafted on that. So Mormons will talk about God being an exalted man at the same time they talk about him being omnipresent. And I don't know of any real theologian who's come along and really reconciled those. I think they're just kind of, they pulled and co-opted a lot of the Christian language from today and grafted it onto that old God. I don't really think it's been synthesized. So I think the old school 19th century Mormon God is a very easy thing to reject. But you know, to me, it just all went out the door, even with that newer, coat of shellac on it. Sorry, did I throw you off by saying God has an anus?
Sort of. I never heard that before, but yeah, what you're saying is literally true according to LDS theology.
But okay, but to me, the Christian God isn't much better. It's just a little more ineffable. You know, does that make it better? There's still no reason from my perspective to believe in a God that doesn't have a body, a God that is, you know, everywhere, that's three in one, you know, what have you. I mean, in a way, it seems to me that the Mormon God is a little more bold, you know, it's willing to stand up and be a man and, you know, claim that it can be reached out and touched. You know, the Christian God, ooh, you can't disprove the Christian God because it's not here, it's not there, it's everywhere. You know, I'm rolling my eyes. It's not really any better.
Well, you sound like Sterling McMurrin. That's what he always says. yeah, I suppose there's truth in that. And, you know, when push comes to shove with Christian apologists, they tend to kind of back into, when they're arguing, tend to back into sort of a cosmological argument, God, that first cause, which is really kind of emotionally unsatisfying to me, you know, to say, well, we know that God is there because if you trace everything back, there's this original cause. But that's not something you love. That's not something you engage in hope with. You know, it's just, who knows what it is, if it's out there. You know, it's not something that fits any of the models that people use when they talk about a belief in God.
Yeah, exactly. Are we going to love a force of nature? Are we going to worship gravity?
Yeah, true. And then there's always the question of, if God was the one who, the first cause or the first mover that brought the universe into play, then of course the next logical question is, well, who's the first mover or who was the first cause that brought God into existence? So no matter what, you're always going to go back to to nothing.
You know, to me, you've just summed up the entire debate between the two parties. It seems like everything gets reduced to this, well, there's sort of complexity or beauty or harmony or love that has to have a cause. But that cause itself, namely God, has no cause. Well, for atheists such as myself, once you posit that there are complex things out in the universe that can have no cause, well, why not this? Why not us? Why not this universe be the thing? Why not basically call it God? Because God has no cause for the believers. So why not this have no cause?
Exactly. I mean, both groups, you know, atheists and theists, believe that there was something original and causeless. You know, the only difference is that we believe it was the universe itself that was causeless, more or less, and the theists believe it was God. So somebody believes that there was, you know, nothing at one point and then something at a later point.
Well, or, you know, actually, I think another possibility is that it always has been, you know? Why do we have this idea that there was nothing and then there was something? Why not always something in some form or another?
Well, that's a very traditional view.
Better explanation. Sorry. Yeah, that's a much better explanation. I should have said that. There's always, I should say both groups believe that there always was X, you know, whether it was the universe or whether it's God, you know, there always was X. It's just something that just both groups inherently believe.
And to our heritage, that's the Mormon view. That's the traditional Mormon view that the universe was, or the grand universe, whatever that was, is a set steady state, an infinite regression of this, you know, becoming, progressing, becoming exalted, becoming a God. And that's the way it's always been all the way back. There was no first cause.
Yeah, exactly. So if we're going to posit something that always existed, well, why don't we posit something that is just matter or material and has no complexity or intelligence, like elements in the universe, hydrogen and so forth. You know, why not just posit that instead of an infinitely complex, infinitely aware, and infinitely powerful, self-aware, cognizant being?
Yeah. Well, and I agree with what you guys were saying about, you know, people say that we need a God to explain the way the universe is, but what explains the way God is? And the same thing happens for other uses of God. Like, why do we have the morals that we do? Why do we have right and wrong? You know, it's because of God. But again, that's not an explanation, because why does God choose those things to be right and wrong? Are they eternal or are they arbitrary? I mean, where does that come from? It's never a good explanation to say, well, it comes from God. I think it's always better to say, well, it is the way it is. Now let's look for another reason if we can. But let's not short circuit the whole searching process by saying it's from God. That stops thought and says that's the end. We're not going to think about it anymore because we have the answer. It's this easy thing. It's God.
Yeah, Lauren, I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's also another thing I find really aggravating about the interplay between atheists and theists, is because an atheist will always say, or a theist will say, that atheists have no reason to have morals or values or standards or anything else, because without a God, then where do these things come from? And for these exact same reasons, you know, sometimes I think, well, what happens when God changes his mind? You know, what if God decides that it's okay to sacrifice your firstborn, you know, all of a sudden? So, I mean, does all of a sudden that particular action become good? So if that's where we draw our source of ethics and morals and values, is from, you know, what God's opinion is at any given time, well, then, you know, there's no such thing as good or evil. It's only what God decides, and God can change his mind at any time.
I think you're right. And I think that we stumbled on actually another part of Mormon theology where there's a schism today, and where traditional Mormon theology might have something more interesting to say. And that's that in traditional Mormon theology, good was completely independent of God. God was good because he recognized it to be good. Now, I'm actually using the language of the Euthyphro from Plato. You know, he hashed this whole thing out 2,500 years ago. But so for traditional Mormonism, this good, this thing that we ascribe to, Allah Alma, God ceasing to be God, exists independent of God. So I think in traditional Mormon theology, you can kind of get yourself out of that. But then you have God as a subservient being to this force out there, which is goodness. And as I've asked some apologists before, if that's really the case, why don't we worship the goodness rather than God? Because God is just its servant. And they don't really have a good answer for that one.
That's an interesting point. You know, if, like you're saying, it's true that good and evil are independent concepts or things that exist outside of God, well then what's preventing an atheist from tapping into those things just like God taps into them? So why can't atheists be good for those reasons alone?
Yeah, good points.
Yeah, and then you have Joseph, who kind of muddied the waters, you know, with things like Nephi chopping off Laban's head, you know. So the church has that tension between this this universal good that shows up in the Book of Mormon and elsewhere in theology, and this strong, you know, drumming to obedience to authority. And I think the underlying thought behind that, or the philosophy behind that, is that we don't necessarily always recognize good, that our father or other priesthood authority might recognize what's ultimately best for us, and God is the same way, that even though God is God because he adheres to some higher morality, we don't have access to that higher morality without a mediator, so we need to just believe everything he says. And if he says chop off Laban's head, then you darn well better chop off Laban's head. But I think for people like us, that answer is very unsatisfactory.
Exactly, because there are so many different gods in the world. You know, how do we know which one's morality to follow?
So we've talked a little bit about morality. Let's take this back to a little bit more personal level. How do you derive your morality? Where do you get your moral center from?
Me or Lauren?
Both of you. Whichever.
You go first, Jason.
Okay, me. I'm not a moral relativist at all. It's kind of what do you call it? Counterintuitive. But I'm a moral absolutist. Even though I'm an agnostic, borderline atheist, I'm a strong moral absolutist. I think that good and evil and right and wrong kind of exist, you know, independently of, you know, the human experience. Kind of like, you know, Plato, he talked about his, what do you call it? The ultimate form, or the pure expression. It's something that we can aspire to but can never achieve. What was the word that Plato used? Do you remember?
The forms, I think you're right. And he would talk about the good with a capital G, sort of.
Okay, right. So I believe that, you know, good and evil, right and wrong exist as, you know, forms, like the way Plato, envisioned them. And so I just think that just instinctively we can more or less tell what is right and what is wrong. Specifically, if you, that which hurts or harms, or, well, like I said, in some way just hurts or harms another, would be instinctively evil, whereas something that you know, helps or exalts or assists someone else would be inherently good. Now, of course, sometimes, you know, you have to harm things just to get your daily sustenance, you know, because we, you know, we being humans, we can't photosynthesize our own energy. But, you know, beyond that, I think it all comes down to harm or help. Or I hope that's not too simplistic.
No, I don't think so. Lauren, how about you?
Well, you know, for me, I'm always humbled by the some of the people who are really interested in philosophy and have, you know, read all about that. That's not me. I'm a hard science guy, but when it comes to philosophy and morality, I am kind of like what Dr. Shades, what Jason explained, that it's instinctual. I just go with my gut when it comes to that kind of thing. I don't know where it comes from. Maybe it's the light of Christ. Who knows? Maybe it comes from the way I was raised, but I really just do what I think is right. And I think I'm usually right. And the best thing I have to justify it is the kind of life I've lived.
Yeah, you know,
I've got no guilt and no worries. That's it.
Well, that's a good way to live if you have no guilt and no worries. But
well,
you know, not long ago, I had lunch with a person who's fresh on the ex-Mormon trail, and this person was lost my train of thought. He was talking about what do I do about Christ, or how am I supposed to feel about Christ, and you know, what about Christ after the whole LDS experience? And I told him that the whole concept of Christ is useful. Even if he didn't exist, it's useful. It's an archetype for ideal behavior. For example, the old, WWJD, what would Jesus do? I mean, in pretty much in nearly all situations, in my humble opinion, you can ask the question, what would Jesus do? And even for an atheist, the answer kind of comes right into your head. You know, does it not? So I think that, so similarly, if you were to ask, if you were faced with some sort of moral dilemma or a fork in the road, so to speak, you might say, what is the right thing to do? And even an atheist, who supposedly doesn't have a source of morals, would just instinctively pick up on what is the right thing to do.
So Jesus is at the switchboard of the railroad track, and there's a train coming down, and there's one guy who's going to get run over the train, or there's three guys that are going to get run over the train. Which way would Jesus, switch the – let's see. So if Jesus didn't switch anything, the three guys would get run over. But if he did switch the rails, only one guy would get run over. Now, what would Jesus do?
Well, I'm sure he would this is just taking a guess, but I'm sure he would choose to have the one guy ran over, not the three. Would he not?
Okay. I think that's what most people would say, right?
Yeah, of course, once again, that which I said about, it being instinctive as to what the right thing to do is, whether an atheist or a theist, that's probably pretty simplistic. And I'm sure other people could come in with, really, really tough moral dilemmas that, aren't so easily answered. But just as a quick, catch-all 30-second type explanation, I think, that's probably the best thing I can come up with.
Mm.
So
right.
I hope that's okay.
I think for me, I think my answer sort of is in harmony with both of yours. I think that most people who take a look at the world can see there's consequence. I mean, it's a simple lesson that we teach our children very early on, and they learn instinctually that when you put your hand on a stove, you get burned. So once we get the idea that any action can have consequences, and those sometimes are part of the laws of the universe, sometimes they're more arbitrary, but any action can have consequence. And then I think if you take an evolutionary psychology view, I think that we have a lot of things programmed into us. We recognize suffering in other beings. We have an innate sense of fair play. We like to protect those who are in the in-group. We have a developed sense of love. And all these things are kind of hardwired into our brain. And I think you can find evolutionary reasons why they got there. But all that kind of comes together with basically the form of morality that exists universally in all religions. We don't hurt other people. We don't take from others. And take something like stealing. There's consequences. You might feel like you cheated, that you might feel guilt over that betrayal of sense of fair play and fairness. But more importantly, you might get caught. You might get punished. There might be real consequence. Somebody might hurt you from taking their things. So I think all those things come naturally without having to abstract any sort of weird God. But I like what you said about the archetype for somebody like Jesus, because I think that's really what happens. In using kind of Freudian language, it's the superego. And if you actually look at like portrayals of Jesus throughout history, they change to match like the idealization of manhood or the idealization of personhood. You look at the Mormon Jesus and he's muscular and he's very square jawed and now in the last 10 years, he's always smiling where that's seen as more of a positive thing than it was, say, 100 years ago. Look at all the photos from 100 years ago. Nobody smiled. So I think we really tend to abstract those things that are buried deep inside our psyche and simplify them and turn them into myths. And that's where religion comes from. So to shorten that up, I think morality and that sense of what is good comes from within us, and it's something we evolved. Maybe we could have evolved on a different path and not had it. Maybe if we had gone down another path, we wouldn't have any concept of love or any concept of fair play, but we are what we are.
Yeah, indeed. If you're going to throw that into the mix, you know, it kind of makes you wonder what we could have had that we don't have, thanks to our evolutionary path.
Yeah, indeed. You know, kind of on that note, this was playing through my head a little bit earlier when we talked about our paths out of the out from Mormonism into atheism. You know, my wife Zilpha also is an atheist, and for her, she first rejected the idea of the devil. And this was before I kind of ended up as an atheist, but she came to the conclusion that there was no super evil, there was no super evil force, and there was no devil. And from that kernel, the rest of it fell for her. Once she decided there was no devil, it wasn't very long, I'm talking a couple of weeks on the calendar, before then she then decided there wasn't a God either. So she kind of took a different route than I took. But this same sort of thing, once you reject those ingrained ideas of evil and sin, you know, the rest of it sort of falls like a house of cards also.
Now, that's very interesting.
Yeah, and for her, it was always the most troublesome parts. You know, this idea that there can be this outside force, which, you know, in Mormonism and evangelical Christianity, you know, they grant the devil a great amount of power over human beings, and just inordinate power and authority and all that sort of stuff to muck things up. And that can be a very fearful thing for a lot of people. You know, the idea that this devil can influence, and, you know, I take something like the Mormon fear of Ouija boards. That can be real and palpable. And I think it was her rejection of that that led her down the path.
You know, so I served my mission in South America, and down there, the evangelicals and the Catholics, you know, both had really even more palpable beliefs about evil. You know, they believed in demon possession, like left and right. They were having exorcisms. They, this was in Brazil, so they also had a lot of African beliefs that had entered into the culture. And so they had like this voodoo and macumba that they believed in and were afraid of. And the missionaries, especially the native missionaries, would pass around these stories and really believe in them. And to me, it really sounded like a bunch of ghost stories. It was so over the top. And so I kind of, I think, maybe went down the same path as Zilpha, where I was taken even to the further extreme out of what I was used to in Mormonism to a place where, you know, people believed that the devil was walking down the street. And I was skeptical of that. And then I backtracked from that and became skeptical of the things that I had also heard about in Mormonism, like Ouija boards and, you know, temptation even. Yeah, I can see how that also had an effect on me and kind of was a stepping stone to, you know, having a lowered belief in the power of good as well, which just the same, I really couldn't see the effects, you know, of prayers being answered and people being healed. It didn't seem any more real than, you know, the demon possessions and the exorcisms.
Okay, now, Lauren, if you started drawing those conclusions that if belief in demonic possession and so forth was a bit too over the top and you applied it to your God belief, how long between when you came back from your mission was it before you lost your faith in Mormonism?
Well, it was pretty quick. I think I came back from my mission basically exhausted with 24/7 church life, and I wanted to take a break. And I would say I never really returned to full activity after my mission. I mean, I went to BYU. I finished up at BYU, but I just went through the motions. I got married in the temple, but I went through the motions basically for, you know, social pressure reasons. You know, I'm from a Mormon family and was expected to do all of these things. But inside, you know, there was a constant erosion from partway through my mission until, you know, by the time I finished up at BYU, I was done.
Oh, that must have been pretty difficult to go through those motions, considering how much is expected of you in that particular religion.
Yeah, it was. And I think because of that, when, you know, the dam finally broke, there was some bitterness that took you know, it took a while to get over, you know, the feelings of, wow, I have really done a lot of things in my life, because of pressure, you know, for the wrong reasons, for reasons that weren't true to myself.
Okay. And, how about this? Going through the motions is one thing, but I think the most difficult thing, the most difficult motion to go through while being an unbeliever is tithing. So what did you do about tithing?
I paid tithing. I mean, I was going to BYU. I was getting a, you know, I was getting a discount. So I paid it. You know, I still believed in a sense. I think I felt like it was just a change in the weather, you know. It was cloudy. Eventually the weather was going to change and my belief would return. And in fact, when I finished at BYU and was ready to have my first child, that's when I decided, okay, now's the time. It's now or never. I'm going to bring a child into the world. How do I want to raise this child? And so I tried to go back to church and become active. And I went back to church at that point with a different perspective. I viewed it from an outsider's perspective to see what did it look like to my investigators, especially the investigators that were a little bit skeptical of the church. What did the church look like to them? And I couldn't stomach it. You know, it really was, by that point, I was fully applying the skepticism that I had applied to those missionary ghost stories. I was fully applying it to the talks that I heard in sacrament meeting and the Sunday school lessons. And I decided, no, I don't want to raise my child with these kinds of ghost stories and having to apologize for, no, we don't really believe what Sister so-and-so said about, you know, about angels surrounding the temple to keep out the, you know, evildoers and, you know, these kinds of things. I didn't want to have to deal with that with my children. And I really reflected on myself and my level of belief and decided, no, that's it. I don't believe, and I don't want to perpetuate this belief.
Very interesting. Thank you.
I've heard several different people who go through a crisis of faith and stare down atheism sort of talk about a sort of horror they feel when they contemplate the idea of no afterlife or that there's no real meaning outside of, you know, what human beings put into things. How do each of you sort of deal with this emotional conundrum? Or maybe there's not one for you, but I'm sure at some point the thought has crossed your mind.
Okay, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. You know, the terror of coming to the realization that, you know, maybe there isn't a God after all, and, you know, what is the purpose of life, and, you know, what if there is no afterlife, then what's it all about? Right. And in my case, you know, the way I guess you would say cope with it is that I just you know, look back at all of you know, world history, and you know, evolution, you know, being what it is, you know, all three of us and everybody listening to this podcast are members of the single most highly advanced species that has ever come into being on this planet, ever, bar none. And not only that we're also at the pinnacle of technological advancement that this particular species is currently enjoying, ever, bar none. And we're also living in one of the freest countries that this, you know, that our species has ever produced, bar none. So we're kind of, you know, when it comes to all life on Earth, you know, we are it. We are at the cutting edge. We are literally nature's greatest miracle. And that's what I take comfort in.
Yeah, I like that positive outlook. I feel that way too. I remember kind of staring into the void myself. And I think I mentioned this at the end of the earlier podcast that I was on. For me, saying that, you know, all meaning in life derives from God really doesn't do it, because I can imagine God needing to derive his meaning from somewhere else also. And if God can do it, why can't I? If God can decide that, you know, my meaning is to exalt mankind, then why can't I decide what my meaning is?
That's a really good point. You know, once again, theists will often say that, you know, without God, there is no meaning, and, you know, what's the meaning of life or anything else without God? And to that, my response is, well, what's the meaning of life with a God? Okay, let's say that, you know, Mormonism and everything attached to it is true, for just a moment. So let's say that, you know, we go through this life, we become exalted, we become gods. You know, what does it mean? Well, it's still meaningless. So we become gods. Big deal. So what? You know, the only meaning that's there is that whatever we choose to attach to it. So it goes with my particular agnosticism right now. You know, I attach meaning to my particular life, not only due to what I, you know, just said about evolution and so forth and us being on the cutting edge, but you know, I get to choose my own meaning. I mean, I am literally the only me that's ever been, and I'm the only me that there ever will be, and this is the only chance that I've got. I mean, sure, it may, you know, make no difference to anything in the grand eternal scheme of things. There may be no real meaning behind anything at all, but there's meaning to it for me. And that's all that I need. That's all that really matters.
Yeah, I do think there is a mourning period that probably most will go through. I've heard some describe that they just felt elation at the idea. But I think for most of us, we sort of have to give up on dreams that, you know, we're not necessarily realistic or not that satisfying. I know Julia Sweeney talks about in one of her monologues that she had to go through and re-mourn the people who had died, because before, you know, she believed they'd gone on to heaven, and now she had to come to terms with the idea that they died, and that was the end. But I went through the same sort of process, that dark night of the soul where you have to face that down, but it just sort of gets better, I guess. And I think there's a much more, for me, there's a much stronger satisfaction with realizing that I'm facing the world as it is. If, for example, I died tomorrow and I woke up on the other side, well, that would be great and all, I guess, but it doesn't really help me here and now, because now I want to try to live the best life I can. And I think the idea that there's not another chance, you know, if I don't spend the time with my kids now, it's not going to have the eternities to do it, I think focuses and makes the things that I have here and now today sweeter.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it can make things a lot more meaningful if you subtract any kind of belief in the afterlife, because you literally are forced to enjoy and take greater meaning in the things that happen now. Rather than this life just being some kind of cosmic test, you know, this life is it. This life is the afterlife. So heaven and hell is what we make right now, and that makes every single day of our lives much more meaningful than if we were just waiting for something, you know, to happen 80 years from now.
Yeah, although, you know, for people who have a really rotten life, you know, people who are born maybe with very severe disabilities or in countries where they have, you know, nothing, you know, for them, it makes it all the worse that this is all the life they get. This is the one chance they get. To me, personally, I think reincarnation would be way cooler than immortality. I've been going on as the same person, you know, in an afterlife. I think it would be way more exciting to live again, to be another person in another body, in another time, in another family. Gee, that would be the most exciting thing for me. But yet there's no, you know, there's no evidence for that either. As far as I'm concerned, it's just wishful thinking.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. Well, you know, once again, you know, thanks for catching me on that, because I guess I was sort of projecting. I mean, maybe I wouldn't be, you know, so thrilled about my, you know, about making every day the best that it is if I was, you know, once again born with some kind of debilitating disease or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's true. And that, you know, that thought of, you know, I think of some kid who grew up in, you know, in abject poverty and died in a tsunami when they're seven, and try to make meaning of their life in any particular way, it's very hard to find any sort of pattern that can make that meaningful. Mormonism, I think, to Joseph Smith's credit, he tried. You know, the idea that, hey, it doesn't matter what happened in life, we can just baptize you a thousand years later by some 12-year-old in Payson. To me, that's very a very unsatisfying answer as to meaning.
Yeah, it is an improvement, as you said.
Yeah, yeah. Well, gentlemen, it's been another fascinating hour. I've enjoyed talking to you both immensely, there's still more to be plumbed. So maybe we'll have to pick up this conversation again on another time.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on once again. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, sounds good, John. It's a good time.
All right, as always, the discussion continues at the website, MormonExpression.com. You can send us an email at mail@mormonexpression.com or call us at our illustrious number 801-906-6722 and leave a message.